Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget your machete as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
I hit record and immediately the clock started playing A Love Affair, An Affair to Remember. This is Monsteropolis, a show about anomalies, legends, and monsters. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined as always by my pal, Mark Matzke.
Hey, how's it going there, Seth?
It's going great. It's, I got to tell you, the coronavirus situation has not changed at all. But that's because we have just recorded the last episode. So maybe by the time are listening to this, things are much better. Let's hope. But I also promised we wouldn't talk about the coronavirus on this week's episode. So let's get away from that. And,
okay.
Did we get any letters? Didn't I feel like I forwarded you something recently, but maybe I didn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, you did. And it, escaping me.
It's okay. I got my stuff here.
Okay.
We got a few, we talked about the Bigfoot Gumbo podcast. Oh yeah. We got an email from, Steven. I'll just say Steven. And he was just saying, hi there, just checking in to say, if you did a live taping in Wadsworth, I'd be there. So as to not waste an email, I have a question. Can you comment on the recent Bigfoot video that took place down at Salt Fork? You know what? As bad, and I'm glad that he sent this and that I said this right now, because this will give me something to mention, and maybe we can all look forward to it. We are not only going to do like a Bigfoot. We are not only going to do a live Monsteropolis show here in lovely Wadsworth, Ohio. But when this all ends, we're going to throw some sort of like celebratory Monsteropolis party and like rent out some back room at a restaurant here or something. We're going to do something to celebrate.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So sometime this summer, hopefully we can do some sort of, we haven't done a Monsteropolis meetup, but we used to do Sasquatch meetups. No. We did two of them.
Yeah.
We did. And they were great. We had a visitor from Alaska once, Beans.
Yep.
Traveled all the way across the country. Yeah.
Yeah.
When we get back, and it is funny. I was just thinking of that this morning. It's like, I really, once things get leveled out, I want to just get together with people. I can tell you, and again, I'm not trying to go off on the coronavirus thing again, but I can tell you one thing, that I think this will do for me personally is to return somewhat to enjoying the moments when they happen. I'm a worrier constantly, but once you've survived, or gone through the valleys, I think you do appreciate things when they're, less crazy. So, we'll do some sort of meetup, but, for sure.
We'll emerge from the bunkers and be ready. We will be so ready.
We will. I'll be eating a Reuben or three Reubens.
One in each hand.
Yeah. Okay, so he asked about the Salt Fork video. Did you watch that video?
I started to watch it. I watched up until sort of the figure was spotted, and I just bailed at that point. I was like, this, I don't know. It didn't do anything for me. I mean, you know how it is. Every time that legitimate Bigfoot sightings have typically one thing in common, and that is that if you get to see the creature move, it's generally described as being, you know, like, take the most athletic person that you've ever seen and multiply that infinitesimally, and that's how these things move through the woods. And so to see something sort of lumbering along, sort of disheveled looking, it's just right away to me.
Yeah.
The warning bells go off. And,
yeah.
You know, the location at this point, I don't know if I would say it's hard to take seriously, but it's
hard to take seriously.
Yeah. It's cliche.
Yeah.
Sure. Salt Fork sighting. Well, yeah. Okay. That was my impression.
Yeah. I'm with you. I don't have, I never have much to say about this kind of thing in general, like Bigfoot videos. But yeah, this one was especially sort of lame, I thought. I think that's all I have to say about the Salt Fork video. I haven't watched, there was an interview somewhere with the guy that shot it, and I haven't watched it. So I don't know if he was, you know, sounded honest or what, but the video itself just looked silly, the movement and everything.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Grafton Monster, which is it's funny. I remember the first time I heard about the Grafton Monster, and it was at the Flatwoods Monster premiere. As insane as that might sound, it was that recent. Like I just somehow it had escaped me. I'd never noticed anything about the Grafton Monster before, and I talked about it with the Mothman historian, as he goes on Twitter. And he was the one that clued me into he told me about Gray Barker's involvement and all that stuff. So that was the first time I ever heard about the Grafton Monster. And then of course it became a huge part of the Fallout 76. And I think it gained some notoriety. They built a billboard there in Grafton and things like that. Now, I don't know if that billboard got put back. There was a billboard in Grafton that was purchased and placed there by locals that was like a welcome to the home of the Grafton Monster kind of thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. And I can't remember. I know it got stolen and I'm not sure if it ever came back.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, but yeah, how do we do this? Have we even done, I don't know that we've done a story that was just solely about one little case like this I don't know that we've done an episode really. I guess the
closest thing would be like Dover Demon.
Cisco Grove.
You know what I mean?
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think if you want, I mean, we should probably say that the Grafton Monster story and this episode sort of begins a loose West Virginia series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're going to push forward into other areas of West Virginia over the next couple of episodes. So this starts, I don't know if it's going to be a trilogy or what will happen, but this is something we've been sort of knocking around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to do West Virginia. We finally we're going to do it. So
yeah.
And
apparently West Virginia is like the safest place in America to be right now. So, so how do you want to do this? Because I feel like if you just run down the Grafton Monster story, we're going to be over with this episode in minutes because it's a very, brief sort of story. So I don't know where to start.
We'll just start because this struck me because, you know, with insane amount of time on my hands, I'm like doing a little extra with these stories.
Good.
Including like plotting them on maps and stuff like that on Google Maps. So Grafton, West Virginia is about 60 miles southwest of Ohio Pile. And if you track it, it falls on the same ridge or axis as the Chestnut Ridge.
No way.
It's the very, very extreme southern tip.
Okay.
You could make a case that it is, at the very least, oriented towards the Chestnut Ridge. Mm-hmm. And you could even, I think, successfully make a claim that it's the southernmost part. So it by itself grabbed my attention when I just plugged it into Google Maps. It's like, well, look at that, because it just, the ridge extends then going northeast through Ohio Pile and all of those other locations that we've come to know and love, you know, like Derry and Greensburg and all of those places.
I had no idea. And to the south, actually, I mean, Grafton sort of, the way to get to Grafton, I drive by Grafton when I go to Flatwoods. So you go right past the exit. And they're not that far removed. And the other funny thing about that stretch of road is right below Flatwoods is Clendenin, which is where the first Mothman sighting was.
So yeah.
There's like this stretch of road there where all the main monsters hang out.
Right. That's wild.
Can you describe, go ahead.
Well, even a little further north also, like along 77 by Parkersburg, is allegedly the site of the
Indrid
Derenberger Cole. Yeah. And Indrid Cole.
Yeah.
So that, something with roads in that area.
Yeah.
For sure.
Let's talk about the look of this thing, and then we'll get into talking about other aspects, like the actual case, I guess. But the Grafton Monster is said to be like a massive, I don't know, I'm sure you have some sort of estimate on height.
What
is it, like 10 feet?
20 feet? The original witness claimed 55 feet.
Yeah.
7 to 9 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And extremely wide, top to bottom, sort of 4 feet wide was the number that Robert Cockrell came up with in his sighting report.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the weirdest element of the description is that it had slick, seal-like skin.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, no apparent head. I mean, that's pretty weird too. But, and like a whitish cap to the skin.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got this weird, slippery, huge thing that one individual saw while he was driving, coming around a bend in the road.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, because I think you're going where I was going to go.
Oh, no. I mean, this, in some senses, this is the epitome of a small town monster's report or case.
That's exactly what I thought. And mm-hmm. it's got all the staples of STM, and it's got a lot in common with Flatwoods, because it's really sort of an isolated event. Now, I've got some events from 1960. I have an event from 1961 that involves the Flatwoods monster, the Grafton monster. But this is 1964, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, and then I've actually got a report from later, regarding the Grafton monster that kicks up sometime in 66. There was sort of a resurgence, but it actually bears some similarities to what I'm going to talk about in the next episode, and that is the case of the Flatwoods monsters.
Mm-hmm.
See what I did there? Which are not at all related to the original Braxton County Green Monster. So it seems like Bigfoot reports and the Grafton Monster and the Flatwoods Monster all sort of meld together. But so the case kicks off in 1964. There's this guy, Robert Cockrell, who's writing for the Grafton Sentinel. Is that right?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. And he's a newspaper reporter. And he, why don't you tell the story? Because I have a feeling I'm going to just jog through it too quickly.
Okay,
at least the initial encounter.
All right, well, he is driving late at night, about 11 o'clock. He's rounding a curve on Riverside Drive, moving at a fairly good clip. He estimated about 50 miles an hour. And he sees standing in the grass between the road and the Tigert River, something immense and white. And it's, as we mentioned before, 7 to 9 feet tall with this sort of slick, hairless look to it. And he saw no apparent head. And so that bothered him to the degree that he sped off and did not stick around to observe where this thing went. But, you know, his reporter instincts did kick in. He did go back to investigate the site. He took a couple friends with him named Jerry Morse and Jim Mauser. Mm-hmm. And so they covered the area where Robert Cockrell had the sighting. And what they did find was not anything as distinctive as a footprint necessarily, but they found a lot of brush that had been mashed down, leading down to the riverside. And by far the strangest element to the story is that while they were conducting this search, Cockrell reported hearing a low whistling sound, and he could not identify the source of it, but it sounded organic, like something big making a whistle, and that the sound seemed to follow them around as they went up and down with their flashlights on the bank of this river. And finally, I mean, their search yielded no results. Cockrell was kind of flummoxed by the whistling sound, but that was essentially it to the experience. Mm-hmm. And the next night, you know, they kind of, it's funny, I mean, this is very small townish as well, but the three of these guys resolved they wouldn't talk about it, but especially Cockrell in his position as a reporter was kind of sensitive about the matter, but the two other guys were not, and they started talking, and they started talking enough that the very next night, which would be June 17th, 1964, several groups of teenagers went down to Riverside Drive to the approximate site of the report and, you know, kind of conducted their own loose search. I mean, the report that I saw said that many of them were brandishing flashlights and mallets and crowbars. And in total, probably about 30 teenagers were down there the next night. What happened after that is that the teen search, as it were, was reported in the next day's paper on Thursday, June 18th. The Grafton Sentinel ran an article. It said, "Teenage Monster Hunting Party's Latest Activity on Grafton Scene." Mm-hmm. And so it was sort of a lighthearted, sort of breezy type of article. But that then sent the entire town into sort of a frenzy, so that then by that night, you know, that headline and that front page story came out Thursday, June 18th. That night, it was bumper to bumper on Riverside Drive. Mm-hmm. With people trying to get sightings. And, you know, Cockrell claimed that he found 20 teens who claimed to have a sighting of the headless horror, Grafton Monster. And he also said that he had found a report that indicated that something similar had been seen in Morgantown the previous week. And in the thing that the article or the book that I got that from, which is by Kurt Coy, called White Things, West Virginia's Weird White Monsters, I didn't say what the source of that report was, but just that Cockrell had come across it. And what an interesting idea that in this book that I thought you'd find somewhat intriguing, at least, is that at approximately the same time, it was hitting the news pretty hard in both newspaper and TV reports about the Sisters Lake Monster in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
So at the same time that was like...
Did we both read the same book?
I could have been. Was it White Things?
Oh,
Kurt
no.
McCoy?
No, never mind. Okay. No, sorry. I was thinking you had said George Dudding for some reason. I would pay really close attention to everything. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Dudding writes about the same thing in
okay.
in his book, and I thought that was interesting as well. He also talks about the sightings of Momo for some reason. I'm not really sure why there's a connection, but maybe the headless look of this thing or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I don't know. Dudding also publishes the original articles. Did you have those?
No, I did not see those.
Yeah, he's got them displayed in the book, which is kind of cool. One thing he mentions, and I don't know if you mentioned or read this as well, but he talks about how Cockerell's story was like dramatically edited to appear almost comedic and less serious, and was also dramatically shortened from his original article. So,
wow. Okay.
And what struck me is that Cockerell, of course, because you cannot escape Gray Barker if you're in dealing with any sort of historical case in the state of West Virginia. Cockerell contacts Barker, and Barker shows up and apparently wrote a very detailed story on this that was never released. So he also was given Cockerell's entire unedited story and also never released that. So I don't know. Knowing Barker, he didn't see this as being saleable enough. You know, like he didn't see it as being like something he could really package like he did Flatwoods or Mothman and just kind of let it lie. But Barker was on the scene and not too long after the initial sightings and wrote a detailed story about it that was apparently just never released. And Cockerell's original story has also never been seen. I don't know. I would imagine it's in Barker's archive somewhere, but it's supposedly a much more detailed account of what happened to him. So I thought that was kind of cool. Is there a mention? Go ahead.
In McCoy's book, he does say that it was, like you said, the stories were never released, but it was the Mark A. Hall, the researcher, had access to Barker's files and found it. And basically, McCoy alleges that Hall is the one who kind of brought it back out, at least, you know, to have some name recognition or to say the essentials of the case. Mm-hmm. So otherwise, it probably would have just languished in Barker's files forever. Mm-hmm. Because as you said, it was never something that he pushed too hard.
Yeah.
What is kind of funny, though, is that it is suggested that what Cockerell saw was a hand cart loaded with boxes.
Yes.
And even a variation of that being somebody pushing a refrigerator in a hand cart.
And that was because of an article that ran in his paper. So they tried to debunk their own reporter's account. And it was all because someone drove down that road one night and saw someone pushing a dolly with some boxes on it. And they were like, oh, he misidentified this.
Right.
So that cracked me up.
Right. Yeah, evidently the editor of the paper did not want to take it seriously. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, Cockerell seemed to be taking it seriously, having, you know, been the person on the witness end of it, as well as the reporter. But the editor, I think, did everything he could to discredit it right from the beginning. You know, and that comes across, I think, in the teen angle.
Yeah,
that is taken in that Thursday, June 17th or 18th, June 18th headline.
Now, while all these people were out searching for the Grafton monster, there was some sort of sound they heard. Did you read about that? Like a noise?
No, tell me more about that. I didn't. That was not in this report at all.
Yeah, the initial event went on, after the initial event went on and the hunting parties went out, there were supposedly sounds people were hearing, like sort of a high pitched whirring sound. And they assumed it was the monster watching them from the nearby bushes, breathing. So he had a squeaky breathing thing going on. I was trying to find one thing I wanted to talk about is, so the Grafton monster, they tried to come up with what it was. And my favorite next to the dolly thing is that it was a polar bear, which is amazing.
Yeah.
If there was a polar bear roaming around West Virginia. And do you have any other cases that after this one, or is your report just sort of focused on this?
I don't. The only one that it mentioned as an alternate sighting was the one in Morgantown the previous week. And that's all the more detail that is given. It's just that one passing reference.
Yeah, I've got...
So you said that you had another one.
Yeah, I got one. It's from the 60s. And I want to say like 66. And I found this through newspaper archives. And I was aware of it from before. I think I had actually saved it a while ago. And this was an AP story. But the headline is Grafton Hunts Peeping Tom. The Taylor County monster apparently is a peeping Tom prowler, state police said today. Corporal D.L. Lake of the Grafton Detachment said he had tried unsuccessfully to catch the person who harassed a mother and her two children near here for the past two nights. The family said they saw two shiny objects in a field and somebody tried to enter their house. Lake said the person was a prowler who probably used binoculars from a distance before becoming bolder, and the shiny objects were reflections in the binoculars lens. The report brought back memories of the Braxton County monster, which visited central West Virginia in the early 1950s. So there's a longer version of that story, but that's pretty much, that does like a decent job of summing it up. Basically, a mom and her kids woke up in the middle of the night, looked out the window, and there were eyes watching them from a field. And then whatever they saw, they think tried to get into the house. And since it's taking place in Grafton, they said it was the Grafton monster, you know, coming to pay them a visit. So that is the only like post script on this story I can really find. But we should interview Les O'Dell about sightings around that area, because I'm sure he's got some other weird stories from that area of West Virginia. There's a lot in that area, just in general.
There is. And I think what is really exciting is when we get into the West Virginia folklore to kind of talk about where those stories come from, because West Virginia in particular seems to be a site where the weird creatures that are seen are like exceptionally weird. I mean, Bigfoot and stuff, that's weird enough, of course, but
yeah.
But what people see in West Virginia tends to be way off the end of the spectrum in terms of oddity. You know, Mothman, of course, being one. Grafton monster, this big seal with no head, white creature, Flatwoods monster. They're just singular, very unique, weird things. And, you know, that the part of the fun of that, I suppose, is trying to figure out, well, you know, why West Virginia and not somewhere else?
Right. Yeah. And the folklore, they're so interesting. And I'm just really starting to learn about a lot of that stuff. And a lot of that will play a role in Mothman Legacy, actually, which I think I've talked to you about. But the Irish Celtic heritage there, I think, is where a lot of this weirdness comes from, like the Banshee lore and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But we're going to do a whole episode about the sort of local West Virginia folklore coming up.
Yep.
So wrap up the Grafton story for us.
Well, I think, as we said before, the Grafton monster story is just the epitome of a small town monster's case, the type of which we are intensely interested in and see happening again and again in our nation's history, in which you have a strange creature that is sighted by a small group of people, or in this case, one person initially, and a small search is undertaken, which very quickly leads to a posse type situation where you have numerous people armed in various ways, out looking for a monster. It makes a media splash, if only locally. I don't know that this was even picked up per se outside of West Virginia very much, but at the same time, it does attract the attention of a prominent researcher, as you mentioned, Gray Barker, who does some investigation and some writing, although it remained largely private until it was discovered posthumously. So you just have sort of a lot of the historical strands coming together in the story of the pattern that we're very used to, and even to the extent that, as like you said at the top of the show, is Grafton Monster lives on now in pop culture in various ways that probably would not have, even just 20, 30 years ago, would have been unheard of, that anyone would even be talking about the Grafton Monster, you know, in video games and other pop culture references. There is at least some sense of Grafton Monster living on, and the town tried to do a bit to capitalize on that. Unfortunately, the sign is, I don't know if the sign has been replaced or not, but it just has everything. It has all of those strands. And I have to think that some of the people who were teenagers down there on Riverside Drive are still around today. I wonder what, you know, what their take on the whole Grafton Monster experience would be.
Yeah. Yeah, this is one of those ones that I would love to do something with. I just don't know what it would be. I don't think there's enough there for a movie. I mean, you'd have to, there might be. You'd have to do some deep diving to really find it.
Yeah.
So that's the Grafton Monster story. Next week, we're going to talk about other stuff relating to West Virginia, and probably the weekend after as well. So,
yep.
MonsteropolisMail@gmail.com if you'd like to send us a letter, and we'd love to read it on the show. We'd love to get a big mailbag episode of the show in the next couple of weeks.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And On the Trail of UFOs is out. Amazon, Vimeo On Demand, DVD, Blu-ray through smalltownmonsters.com. So I think that covers it this week. We got more coming.
Yep.
Stay strong to our listeners. And thanks for tuning in through all this.
Yep.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.